Why are dogs in particular such a big threat for Kiwi?
Oh, so really, it's a bit of a perfect storm of something that smells amazing. Like Kiwi, they have a really, like Anna, you would know this, they've got a really unique, musty,
Oh, yes.
strong, interesting, like it's not a bad smell, but it's a really interesting smell. And then you've got, oh, and they live on the ground. They live, in short burrows or just sometimes tucked into vegetation. And then you've got a dog who is an animal that is so driven by its nose. Dogs have incredible senses of smell. Their whole system is really designed for smelling the world around them. So you put these two species together with something that smells very interesting, something that is driven by its nose, and of course, there's going to be an interaction. And then on top of that, you've got the kiwi being flightless, which means they don't have flight muscles. They also don't have a sternum or breastbone, and that makes their whole rib cage really, really vulnerable to being broken. So you can have a dog that is just really genuinely pretty curious, and it might want to get in there for it. Like a better look for a dog is kind of a better smell, right? So get right in there with its nose and either nudge the bird a bit hard, or perhaps give the bird, the kiwi, a little bit of a mouth, which really is the equivalent of us sort of picking something up and looking at it. And that can be enough to splinter the ribs, damage the internal organs, and kill the bird, even some in some cases without the skin being broken.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified. Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna, and today we are joined by Emma Craig from Save the Kiwi. Kia ora, Emma.
Oh, kia ora. Kia ora, Anna. Kia ora, Callum.
It's so great to have you here. To get started, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do with Save the Kiwi?
Oh, sure. Yeah. First of all, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate the chance to come and share with your audience. I work for Save the Kiwi. I've got a dual role. So part of my role is as the Northland coordinator for Kiwi. There is a specific taxon in Northland. Well, actually, slightly further afield than Northland these days, but it's called the Northland Brown Kiwi. So part of my role is to support in the conservation and goals to help that taxon thrive. And the other much bigger part of my role is as the dog specialist. So that's really looking at how we can ensure that Kiwi are happy and healthy and thriving in the presence of dogs.
Thank you so much for introducing yourself, and we will dive into the dog topic shortly. But first of all, what are your three favourite Kiwi facts, Emma?
Oh, there's so many. It's really hard to narrow it down to just three. But one of them is that Kiwi are incredibly long-lived. So I think a lot of us assume that birds live for just a handful of years, and that's true for many species of birds. But for Kiwi, when they're not affected by predation or hit by vehicles or come into any other sort of life-shortening circumstances, they can live for quite a few decades, 60, 65 years plus in some cases. So yeah, really wow. Amazingly long-lived species, which is really cool to think there's Kiwi running around out there that are older than us. That's my first one. The second thing that I find really fascinating about Kiwi is I think everyone knows they have these really huge eggs, and within the egg is a particularly large yolk. And as the chick is growing and developing, it obviously uses a fair bit of that yolk. I mean, it takes almost 3 months for the chick to develop within the egg. But just prior to hatch, there's a bit of yolk that isn't quite used up in the creation of the chick. And that's kind of it sounds a bit like rocket science, but it goes into the belly, kind of gets externalized into the belly just before the chick hatches out of the egg. And you can actually see when they first hatch, they've got this big, soft-looking yellow belly. and that sustains them for about a week until they're able to feed themselves. So by sustains them, I don't mean that they reach down there with their bill and eat it, which when I've told this story to children, is sometimes the picture they get. They take it in internally, but it means that their parents don't feed them at all. They live on that yolk until they've figured out how to feed themselves. So yeah, incredibly precocial little creatures, and yeah, I think that's a pretty fascinating thing about them. And the third thing that I really find interesting about kiwi, and this is actually not so much a shout out for kiwi, but a lot of people say that they've got the biggest or one of the biggest eggs in the world for the size of the female. And it's true, it is a really big egg. It's around 15-20% of the body weight. But I just want to give a tiny bit of love for another species, another of our amazing species, the titipunamu or rifleman, because they have a tiny egg. It's only about 1.5 grams, but the female who lays it is only 7 grams. So that's 21% of her body weight, and she will actually lay up to 5. So she can lay more than her whole body weight in one clutch, which is pretty cool. But kiwi are pretty close up there at between 15-20%. So yeah, huge egg. Pretty incredible.
Far out. That is incredible. I was just, when you mentioned the second fact about kiwi internalizing their yolk so the parents don't have to feed them, I couldn't help but think about a kid going out maybe to the supermarket or to the toy store and say, "Mom, can you buy me this toy?" And the parents like, "No, you got to look after yourself. I'm not even feeding you. Just get out there. You're 3 days old. You need to start looking after yourself in this world." And it's kind of like kiwi parents, really. They're not the ones that coddle their children, are they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they, all the love and attention they give to them is when they're an egg, right? It's like they put so much effort in for the female, like creating those eggs and laying them, and then the male doing, well, for the northern brown kiwi anyway, all of that incubation, sitting there for 3 months, not feeding himself as much as he usually would. They're like, "All right, it's a done deal. My job's done here. I've got to go and look after myself."
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, I don't blame them.
Humans, quite a different model.
Yeah. So kiwi are pretty resilient and feisty for their small size. I certainly have seen Anna come home with big scratches on many occasions. However, dogs and introduced mustelids like stoats, they do pose a big threat to them. Why are dogs in particular such a big threat for kiwi?
Really, it's a bit of a perfect storm of something that smells amazing. Like kiwi, they have a really, like Anna, you would know this, they've got a really unique, musty,
oh yes,
strong, interesting, like it's not a bad smell, but it's a really interesting smell. And then you've got, oh, and they live on the ground. They live, you know, in short burrows or just sometimes tucked into vegetation. And then you've got a dog who is an animal that is so driven by its nose. You know, dogs have incredible senses of smell. Their whole system is really designed for smelling the world around them. So you put these two species together with something that smells very interesting, something that is driven by its nose, and of course there's going to be an interaction. And then on top of that, you've got the kiwi being flightless, which means they don't have flight muscles. They also don't have a sternum or breastbone, and that makes their whole rib cage really, really vulnerable to being broken. So you can have a dog that is just really genuinely pretty curious, and it might want to get in there for it. Like a better look for a dog is kind of a better smell, right? So get right in there with its nose and either nudge the bird a bit hard, or perhaps give the bird, the kiwi, a little bit of a mouth, which really is the equivalent of us sort of picking something up and looking at it. And that can be enough to splinter the ribs, damage the internal organs, and kill the bird, even in some cases without the skin being broken. Some dogs are obviously more aggressive, and they're trying to hunt kiwi, and they will go in for a more aggressive approach, but some dogs, really, it's just curiosity. So that's the problem, is they're both just being themselves. They're doing what their biology is kind of dictating, but it's ending badly for kiwi.
Yeah, and that is so true. Like you say, it doesn't even have to be a hunting interaction. It's just, even we as handlers, right? We're incredibly careful whenever we're handling kiwi because they have that fragile ribcage. It's always by the legs and try to keep away from that area. And huge shout out to Save the Kiwi at this stage for being bold in addressing dogs in conservation. When your role, you know, got expanded to include that, I guess the question is, what's the main purpose for that role, and what are the main goals that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, thanks for that. I guess it came about, so dogs have always been in the picture for kiwi conservation, or certainly for the last few decades. You know, once we became aware that dogs were an issue, a significant issue for kiwi, but there just hadn't really been, within Save the Kiwi, the ability to really put that lens over it, to really focus in on dogs. So just the way things kind of rolled within the organisation, there was the ability to create this role and then to create a strategy and then implement the strategy around dogs. But I think for me, something that really hit home was, so I was part of the Whangarei Kiwi Sanctuary team when we changed our focus. This is going back 15 years or more now, changed our focus from predator control, focusing mostly on mustelids, to dogs, which really is more of a social issue than a predator issue. Mm. And there was a whole team of us doing that. And one of my ex-colleagues said, like, there was a whole team of us looking at this issue in one little area. And now you're one person looking at it nationally. Like, do you think this is going to be quite a big job for you? And it is. It's certainly not a small job, but there's a whole lot of other people working on this problem as well, you know, right around the country from a whole lot of organisations. So I feel like I've got colleagues external to Save the Kiwi, and we certainly try to work together where we can.
Yeah, definitely. When we first got to know you, Emma, you said something that really hit home. Dogs are a part of human evolution. And it's so true. We commonly refer to them as man's best friend. They'll always be part of our society, or at least I hope they will be, because dogs are amazing. But it's all about us working together and moving away from the us versus them approach of, you know, keep dogs away from kiwi. And as kiwi become more prevalent and more common and more popular and less endangered, that's going to be more and more of an issue. So it's amazing that you're addressing this topic so boldly. What are the key challenges that you're facing with dogs and kiwi conservation at the moment?
Yeah, the at the moment part is sort of throws me with this question, because there hasn't really been too much change over time, and there isn't really one big challenge. You know, it's lots of little things that are really ongoing. So, like, certainly with pet dogs, we are asking the same things that we've been asking for years, which is that we want dog owners to keep their dogs under control. We want them to keep them contained at night, and we want them to walk them on leads where there could be kiwi or indeed other vulnerable ground-dwelling birds. So getting that message out there is a challenge, and then getting people obviously to take it on board. But we're certainly seeing there's lots of wins in that area. People are more and more willing to look after wildlife and have their dogs in the same spaces. It's certainly challenging when there are predation events on kiwi by dogs. And, you know, it seems like every few months there'll be yet another story in the media where there's been several kiwi have been found in a short space of time in one area that are showing signs of dog kill. And that's really disheartening for the people who are doing the mahi on the ground to protect those kiwis. So, yeah, that's an ongoing challenge, is just keeping that enthusiasm up where you've got, you know, those real stink days at work where you're finding the bodies of animals that you, in some cases, might have worked with for years. I guess the flip side of that, and this is why I think we still have kiwi, and what really motivates me to keep going, is that kiwi are phenomenal breeders. And Anna, I'm sure you know that all of this already, but, you know, they'll start breeding at just 3 or 4 years of age, and then they'll breed every year. For northern brown kiwi, they'll have typically two eggs per clutch, and quite regularly we'll have three clutches in a season. So they can have 6 chicks. They don't, not every egg will survive, but, you know, up to 6 chicks per year, every year. And as I mentioned before, they're a really long-lived species. So for decades, so the potential for kiwi to replace themselves is really high. So in areas where they are protected, the populations can flourish and can grow really quickly. The other key challenge, I think, and this is really a big unknown, is feral dogs. So I think it's only over the last few years that we've really started to understand that, yes, we all know we've got pet dogs and working dogs, and then some of those might go a bit rogue for a while and be considered wandering dogs or roaming dogs, but they're still kind of associated with people or with populations. But it seems that now we do really have a feral dog population, so dogs that are living separate to humans and breeding and raising their pups, and that we really don't know the damage that those dogs are doing, and we also don't have too many tools to deal with those dogs. So that's a big challenge.
Wow. Feral dogs. Feral cats are a big issue, but I didn't realize feral dogs were an issue and a growing issue in this country.
Yeah, so it's certainly something that the Department of Conservation has started to acknowledge and address. But yeah, like I said, it's sort of pretty fresh, and the number of tools to deal with dogs. There's dock walking tracks that have been closed at times, and there's certainly recommendations for trampers that they don't walk independently, that they walk in groups because of the threat of the dogs to them. So yeah, it's a real issue.
Oh, that's fascinating, and I wasn't aware about that, to be honest, with you and our listeners. I just want to go back to the classic dog ownership. People go into areas that they shouldn't be with their pet dog. What are solutions that we are thinking of at the moment to bridge that very gap between dog owners and conservation needs across the country?
Well, I like to think that there's not really much of a gap there, because a lot of dog owners are conservationists as well, and a lot of conservationists are dog lovers, even if they're not dog owners. Yeah, I think it's just understanding what behaviours dog owners need to take on board to ensure that their dogs can be happy and healthy and thrive, while also allowing wildlife to be happy and healthy and thrive. So part of having a happy, healthy dog is making sure that dog is safe from threats. So if your dog is with you, you know where it is, it's under control, then it's not going to come across unknown threats, like say a roaming dog might. Like a roaming dog that's out there in the world on its own could get hit by a car, it could find some toxin and ingest it, it could find another roaming dog and get into a fight, it could get impounded and then the owner would get a fine. You know, there's a whole lot of reasons why it's not a safe world out there for a dog on its own. So if people are responsible dog owners and they want to do the best for their dogs, then I believe that keeping that dog under control is the best, in the best interest of the dog, but then of course it's also in the best interest of wildlife, which are protected from roaming dogs also, or dogs that are otherwise under control. But we need to make sure that we, like part of that picture is allowing some space for wildlife where dogs either aren't allowed or they're only allowed on leads. But it's really important, I think, for dog owners and indeed a lot of the time for the dogs themselves to have space to run and roam and play and not be on leads. So we need to make sure that there's those spaces as well for dogs. So like off-lead fence dog parks are a great idea, and in areas where there are a high kiwi density, it's probably a good idea for those fences to be kiwi excluding fences so the kiwi can't make their way into the dog parks. And like there's some areas of coastline where there might be, you know, might not be vulnerable birds that dogs can be off lead. And I think a lot of communities are doing this already, but I think it's important that we have that balance, that we don't just have a whole lot of places that dog owners can't take their dogs. If we're saying no to one space, we need to be saying yes to somewhere else, so that yeah, I think it's so much easier to follow the rule when the rule is no, don't hit your dog here because there's kiwi, when there's an alternative on the table, you know, instead of just being like, no, no, no.
And it's really hard for dog owners in a lot of areas if there aren't places for them to walk. I know a number of friends where ask them to come for walks in the forest, and they say, well, we can't just leave our dog at home all day, and we have the choice of going to a park or maybe to a school's field or maybe a certain patch of the beach, and that's it for them. And so apart from walking around neighborhoods where the dogs quite often are, especially if they're a bigger dog, they're getting into fights or at least getting threatened by dogs, it's not that conducive for dog ownership. So I guess it's important, like you say, to have these areas, these parks, and that comes down to policy and planning. One thing I notice is in a lot of areas of conservation in New Zealand, policy planning and rollout is a big thing. Predator control, planting trees, species protection, and especially threatened species. But from what we've spoken about so far, it sounds like you're saying that that is less of a part of the dog issue, and it's a lot more about education, attitude, and behavior. Do you have any thoughts around how your role in dogs and kiwi is different to other areas of conservation in New Zealand?
I think the legislation side of it is important as well. And I actually do, I think we should generally as a population be more involved in that, not just around dogs and conservation, but for everything that affects us, to be honest. And I think that's definitely one of the steps that any listeners out there who want to know what they could do in this space is get involved. Like, every council has dog bylaws, which are the local way of interpreting the Dog Control Act. And those are reviewed at least every 10 years, sometimes every 5 years, depending on the council. And it's worth looking into those and making sure that they're fit for purpose, that they cover what the broader community want in terms of the dogs and indeed wildlife. And it's anyone can make a submission. You can make written submissions, you can make verbal submissions. I think that's a really good thing to get involved with. But yes, in terms of the day-to-day, what we're really asking people to do is just clip your dog on a lead, contain it at night, don't let it roam. It's all pretty straightforward. And then if you do see a roaming dog, whether you're a dog owner or not, reporting that to the council. So it'll be each territorial authority will have a different phone number to report that dog to. So knowing what that number is or how to access it and reporting it for that dog's immediate safety and for the safety of the wider environment, which includes people and wildlife. I'd advocate for that as well.
Yeah, to me, it's all about balance, eh? And you just spoken to that of like, I love the idea of having dog parks that have the fence to keep kiwi out. Like, how cool is that? We always talk about it the other way around. Like, we're so familiar as conservationists with the fence sanctuary to protect our species, but hey, yes, let's turn it upside down and give our beloved dogs the same kind of joy of having that safe space to roam. And you can just, you know, to me, it's also not having to worry as the dog owner if you are in a hot spot. Like, how cool is that? That really, I love that. I'm gonna keep on mulling that over and maybe suggest that to a few policymakers because it's awesome. But also, speaking of, it's such a cool.
Can I just add? Can I add one thing in here before we move on?
Of course.
Cool, thank you. There are also private dog parks, or they may have different names, but private places where people can take their dogs, and they're often set up for reactive dogs, so dogs that might not enjoy interacting with people or dogs that they don't know. And each one's different. They're set up in different ways, but it's often there's a little koha to pay to get in and use that space, and sometimes you can book it ahead so you know that for that hour or whatever, it's just going to be you and your dog there, and you're not going to have any unexpected interactions. So check out to see if there's any of those in your area too, and if there's not, you know, perhaps that's something that you could look at having someone set up, or perhaps you could set up if you've got the land yourself.
Now that is cool, and it's just catering to more needs, right, and to more dog types. And speaking of that and balance, there's also an amazing program offered through Save the Kiwi, which is the Kiwi Avoidance Training. Can you introduce that program? What's the philosophy, and is it suitable for all dog types? Like, why are we having this program?
yeah, this is a big part of my role, Kiwi Avoidance Training. So I'm really happy to talk about that on this podcast. So it's been around since the mid-90s, actually, so quite a long time. It was developed in the Coromandel after a spate of Kiwi were killed by dogs, or a spate of dog attacks on Kiwi. And the people there were like, we need to do something. It seemed in that case it was most likely hunting dogs that were the cause of the problem. And it's like, we're not going to stop people from wanting to hunt. And in fact, hunting's a really important part of conservation in a lot of ways too. You know, without hunting, there'll be pigs and deer everywhere. But again, it's all sort of, that's part of the balance. Yeah, they're like, what can we do? We know that the dogs will still be in this environment where they're a Kiwi. So we want to discourage those dogs from approaching Kiwi. So yeah, set up the program, and it's evolved since then. It's spread to Northland soon after Coromandel, and then since then it's spread nationwide. So yeah, all around the country now, from Kaitaia in the north to Rakiora, Stewart Island in the south. And the way it works is there's an endorsed Kiwi avoidance trainer. So we've got 42 trainers and trainees around the country currently under the program, and they set up a course. People are booked in to bring their dogs along. The course is props that are the Kiwi props. So some of them are freeze-dried Kiwi that have, that have obviously previously died, some from dogs. Some are Kiwi that have died that have been frozen, and some are artificial props that look like a Kiwi, but then they've got really good fresh bedding and Kiwi scat and scent put all around them so that they've got the right smell, because that, of course, like we mentioned earlier, is what drives a dog. There'll be a space set up with these props through the space, and then the dog gets an e-collar put on it, which is used by the endorsed trainer. The dog goes through the course with the owner. If they show interest, like if they start to interact with the prop, and the all of our trainers are really well keyed in to knowing when the dogs are getting that nose full of scent and when it's kind of hitting the brain, and making sure that if they do need a correction through the e-collar, that the timing of that is being on, because that's crucial. So yeah, for most dogs, they come along, they go through the course, they have one correction, which is pretty mild. We want to give the dogs a fright, certainly, but we don't want to hurt them. That's not the intention. And then they typically avoid the other props pretty hard out. And then they'll come back 6 months later. And again, often they just avoid the props. They're like, oh, no, I don't like that smell. I don't want to go near it. And we hear a lot from hunters who have had their dogs in the environment, and the dogs have changed their behavior. They've gone right around like a little bit of, you know, a particular tree, or they've come right into heel at a certain point, and the hunter's like, ah, there's a Kiwi right here. Right, we'll move on. So they can, yeah, it's sort of like a Kiwi detection dog, but an opposite. yeah, for dogs with jobs, for hunting dogs and farming dogs. So these are dogs that have this concept. They're like, okay, I'm allowed to chase pigs, I'm not allowed to chase hares, or I'm allowed to round up the sheep, but if I, you know, chase a possum, I'm going to get in trouble. So they've got this concept of like, this is a yes and this is a no. And they come along to Kiwi Avoidance Training and they get Kiwi added to the no list for them. And yeah, it's certainly no guarantee. There have been dogs that have gone through the program that have gone on to kill Kiwi, sadly. But for the vast majority of dogs, it helps as part of that bigger picture of what we ask dog owners to do to protect Kiwi. Pet dogs, it's a little different, because typically they don't have that concept of like, this is a yes and this is a no. So it's a much bigger ask for them to get the same benefit out of the training. And also for pet dog owners, they usually will have other tools that are more effective and more readily available. So if you live in an area where you don't have Kiwi right where you live, and you don't let your dog roam, you keep it contained at night, you walk it on a lead anywhere that there may be Kiwi, then you don't need to do the training. It's not, you know, those other tools are working for you. But so we do have some pet dogs that will come through, and that might be that they live in an area where Kiwi come right into their backyard sort of thing. And again, it's not going to be the only tool that, that the owners will need to use. It needs to be like a backup secondary tool, but those primary tools of keeping the dog contained, walking on a lead, not letting it roam, those are really the tools that will make the difference.
That's interesting because, yes, it's so important for farm dogs, for working dogs, dogs that have jobs. And you're right, for pet dogs, there are better tools and with that relationship between the owner and the dog. However, Kiwi are starting to come back to our cities. Wellington's a great example of that. So is Whangarei. Mm-hmm. And having Kiwis so close to these human hotspots rather than deep in the Nahiri is a challenge, and it's creating new challenges. So how can we adapt to welcoming Kiwi into our communities and keep them as safe from dogs as possible? You mentioned about having Kiwi exclusion fences for dog parks. Would that mean that, aside from that, would that mean maybe in these areas, Kiwi avoidance training for pet dogs will become more important in cities, or are there other tools that are worth highlighting?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Callum. I just want to just clarify one thing, that we're welcoming Kiwi back to these areas. So these are areas that they've always been.
True.
So I think there's a, it's easy to think that they're coming somewhere new, but it's not new for Kiwi. They've just been missing for a while. So yeah, we should be celebrating that they're back in their home grounds again. And yeah, I think as they are getting into more and more areas, and certainly the work for Western Brown Kiwi that's happening right across Taranaki and down to Pōneke, Wellington, and it's phenomenal, the mahi that's going on there, and Kiwi getting back to places that, like I said, they've been missing for a long time. In terms of Kiwi avoidance training, then it's an appropriate tool in some of those situations, but it certainly shouldn't be the cover-all. For one thing, we don't have the resource for that. Like, we can't train every dog in Pōneke. our trainers need to sleep sometimes. But yeah, it's simply not the most appropriate tool. It's much easier and more accessible for those dog owners to use a dog lead and keep their dog contained at night. You know, if they live, you know, right where there are Kiwi coming right up, butting against their home, then it might be a good secondary tool. But typically, we're not going to be rolling it out citywide.
And that's fair enough. I think what I've learned from today, Kiwi avoidance training is primarily for dogs that have to go into the forests or areas where there are Kiwi to do their job, versus if you've got a pet dog, it's kind of the responsibility is on the owner, like clip it on the lead and just keep an eye on it. But I'm also just thinking, how cool would it be if there's subsidies for people who live in those Kiwi areas to get a Kiwi aversion fence around their garden? So, hey, yes, the Kiwi might be on the other end of your fence, and your dog can still be in your backyard having fun, you know, kids and dogs playing together and Kiwi being safe on the other side. So there's some food for thought.
Yeah, and I've seen that. I know of a number of people who have created like huge, big Kiwi-proof dog runs. This is in Northland, because they want their dogs to be able to run around and they want the Kiwi to be safe. But yeah, there's a bit of cost involved there. But yeah, if you know, what's the value of having Kiwi call right outside your home? You know, that's pretty cool. So to have your happy pooch and to be able to be woken up in the middle of the night by a Kiwi screeching out the window, you know, win-win.
I reckon. I totally agree. And I think there's just many tools that we have to explore to expanding our toolkit that we have to make that, to create that balance. And, you know, I always showcase Whangarei as a case study when people are skeptical because they think of Kiwi and humans being a new coexistence, which it really isn't. We're just returning them to their former range, really. What can people learn? What can other communities learn from Whangarei, where that coexistence has been, you know, it's quite established. It's been there for many years. What are our takeaways from that?
So the Whangarei Heads area was part of the original Whangarei Kiwi Sanctuary. It was a little satellite satellite site there, and we were, this is when I was part of that team and worked for Department of Conservation, and we were monitoring kiwi in the reserve. And yeah, unfortunately we had a real, we had a terrible spate of dog kills there, including, I remember, a gravid female. So gravid means the female has the egg on board, killed right on the track. And there were, you know, some really sad stories that came out of it. And again, you know, some of these were kiwi that we'd been monitoring for years. But it did seem to help galvanize the community. They were like, oh, actually, this is not what we want. You know, this is not okay. We as a collective are letting this happen. So, you know, what are we going to do about it? I mean, the community there has absolutely taken this challenge with both hands and run with it, and have just done phenomenal things. You know, they've grown their kiwi population now from just a handful of birds to over 1,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And spread, like the area that the kiwi are covering now is just, you know, there's kiwi in areas that you just wouldn't have anticipated going back 10, 15, 20 years ago. So yeah, it's really cool. It's definitely a big success story, that one. But I think for other communities who are just getting kiwi back now, they don't need to, relive those same mistakes. They don't need to have the big wake-up calls of having multiple dead kiwi found, you know, on tracks that have been killed by dogs. They can be a step ahead and prevent that happening. So I guess that's, although it's really sad that places like the Whangarei Heads had to go through that process, hopefully that means that other communities won't need to, which would be positive.
Yeah. And I think it's important to consider, like, there's always going to be a bad dog owner that just doesn't care. But the vast majority of people that have dogs have so much love for them. I mean, the amount of time and care and also money they spend and invest into their best friend is huge. And most dog owners will go out of their way, if that's kiwi avoidance training, if that's education, if that's learning, they will. And, you know, that awareness and also community buy-in is so important. But it's not like dog owners are the enemy of kiwi. That's, if anyone is even remotely considering that, that's not the case. As far as I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong there, but
you've got it bang on. Yeah.
great. We're all on the same side.
Not enemies. Yeah,
okay. Yep. Okay, great. So we've had awesome growth in the kiwi population in areas where active conservation has happened. And I'd like to think that this can continue. Right now when we're recording, I'm wearing a shirt with Kiwi Calling from Maunga Tauturi, and they've just had so much success with their kiwi that they've had to remove heaps of them from the mountain. Translocate them from the mountain. And I'd like to see this further afield. We may be walking or moving into a future where we have kiwi all over the place in abundance. That would be great. And that does raise the question, where do dogs fit into that? So what does success look like in 10 years and in 50 years for kiwi conservation when it comes to dogs?
Oh, well, like I said, with the Whangarei Heads area, you know, there are kiwi turning up now where it was just unanticipated. And you just mentioned Maunga Tauturi. I mean, that project, 222 kiwi were translocated off the Maunga this year. And next year, there will be even more. So that's like, when we started doing this, getting, you know, we'd do translocations of 5 or 6 kiwi, you know. So to be doing in the hundreds now is just phenomenal. And I think it means I can't really predict 50 years from now, but I'll take a stab.
I'll take a stab at
10 years. I think as conservationists, we're going to need to be asking the question of like, okay, we're moving kiwi from A to B, but we need to make sure we've got C, D, and E lined up as well, because the populations are going to thrive and boom. And then we need to know where's next after that, because they're just, you know, the little breeding machines. People are going to control their dogs. They're going to keep an eye out at night when they're in their cars, and the kiwi will be going through the roof. So we need to make sure we've got plenty of places, plenty of habitat for them to live. But the great thing about kiwi is they're so adaptable, and anywhere there's insects and a little bit of cover on the ground, they're happy. So they don't need to be in pristine forest, although I'd love to see more pristine forest for a whole lot of other species. Yeah, kiwi are sort of generalist when it comes to what sort of habitat they're happy to be in. So plantation forest, all good. Gorse, all good. Pampas, all good. Blackberry, anything prickly or sharp, it seems. But yeah.
Not so good if you're the handler.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they'll live anywhere that they can, really. So let's create the space for them to be able to do just that.
I love that answer. I just had goosebumps when you said, imagine having kiwi in more spaces. Please, kiwi, don't go into the gorse and the blackberry when you're about to have your health check, though, because it's not cool. Been there, done that, and I'm sure you're the same, Emma. And, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Love, yeah.
I had the pleasure of living on a kiwi crash island for 3 and a bit years when my children were quite small, and they would get woken up regularly by kiwi at night, and in the morning they'd be like, oh, I could barely sleep last night, there were too many kiwi calling. And I want that to be a little story that more parents hear from their kids in the morning.
That would be amazing, and it is definitely within reach with everything that's happening in kiwi conservation at the moment. So we had an amazing time chatting. I've learned a lot today. To sum up what we talked about, what are practical tips for how people can help nature? Like, what can dog owners do, and what can communities do to make that future happen?
Okay, well, I'll be probably repeating myself pretty hard out here. The listeners might be able to say this before me, but for dog owners, yeah, really keeping dogs under control, keeping them contained at night, walked on leads anywhere that there are kiwi or other vulnerable birds. And then if you've got a hunting dog, then I'd add to that kiwi avoidance training is a great option with an endorsed trainer. Hunting during the day so that you're not interacting with kiwi while they're out and about at night. And keeping your pack size small, making sure that you bring all your dogs home with you is really important. So that's sort of what individual dog owners can do. And then for communities, getting involved in the legislative process, it's so exciting. But yeah, contributing to your local dog bylaws when they come up. You know, maybe if it's time to vote for your councillors, figuring out where they stand on this side of things. You know, it's a way that we can make a tangible difference. And then if there's any roaming dogs around, reporting them to the local territorial authority to keep that dog and the wider public and wildlife safe.
Awesome. Thank you, Emma, for summarizing these powerful messages, what we can do to really create that balance. Now, coming to you, what does conservation mean to you, Emma?
Well, conservation means balance to me, really. It's what you've just said. Yeah, so like conservation's dynamic. It's always changing. I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where we're like, okay, this is it. You know, this is what we were trying to get back to or trying to get forward to. Let's stop now. It's dynamic. It's always changing, but it's ensuring that the balance is there so that that all species have the ability to adapt and change. You know, it's a changing world. Things are getting warmer all of a sudden. So giving ourselves and all the other species that inhabit this beautiful land the ability to adapt and change as well.
Ah, that's really interesting, because everyone has a different conception of what conservation means. It's so fascinating to hear your view of it. It just builds a wider picture of what conservation really means. To wrap it up as a final question, how can people get involved, support your work, learn more about Save the Kiwi and what you're doing?
So if you go to the Save the Kiwi website, there's lots of ways there that you can get involved. And lots of information there about what we do. You might want to sign up for the Save the Kiwi newsletter. And within your immediate community, if you're not already doing it, then getting involved in a local community group, maybe getting out there doing some trapping, perhaps doing some kiwi call count monitoring, like Helen was just mentioning at Maungatauturi, keeping an eye out on all the neighbourhood dogs, make sure they're doing the right thing. But yeah, whatever is the, you know, whatever suits your time and your enthusiasm and your abilities, there'll be some way that you can help nature. There's research that if we're out there in nature, it's really good for us. But if we're out there in nature doing things to help nature, that it's even better again. So do yourself a favour, do the planet a favour. Just get out there on the ground and do what you can to help.
Kia ora, that's an amazing message.
So be more people helping nature. That's great. Emma, yeah. It has been so fascinating chatting with you today, having a kōrero, learning about dogs and kiwi. I've certainly come away with some great learnings. So thank you again for joining us. And really appreciate having you here.
I've loved it. Thanks so much for chatting with me, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in. And hopefully everyone will go home and walk their dog on a lead.
Thank you. Kia ora, Emma.